From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. Later in the broadcast, graphic novels, their relationship to education and diversity. We'll talk with author Jean Luen Yang. But first, as the November elections approach, political campaigns are sending out a flood of fundraising emails. Some ask for $5, some for $500. Maybe you oblige, maybe you don't, because you're so sick of these electronic leaflets that you've stopped opening them. Over the last two decades, email has become a valuable tool in the campaign war chest, so valuable that there's a science to crafting a subject line and message that get results. Every time a quarterly financial reporting deadline approaches, the emails surge. Yesterday was the last deadline before the November election, so that explains the heavy volume of emails this week. But how many is too many? Can an email deluge backfire? Joining me to examine the use or maybe overuse of political campaign email is Nick O'Mealy. He is author of The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. He's a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He joins us by telephone. Nick O'Mealy, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Kojo.
You too can join the conversation with your comments or questions by calling 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Are emails from political campaigns flooding your inbox? Do you read them? You can also shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Nick, sometimes we get emails from candidates we've never had any contact with. Where do campaigns get the email addresses they use? Do they sell them to one another? Do they trade them?
Well, selling and buying email lists and even trading lists is generally frowned upon. It can increase the likelihood of spam complaints and ultimately get you blocked. For the most part, if you're getting an email and you don't think that you don't know who it's from and you didn't sign up for them, they may be sending it to a list on your behalf. For example, if you signed up for Barack Obama's email list in 08 or 2012 in one of those campaigns, you might get an email from one of the Senate candidates this cycle the Obama team will either send an email to their list on behalf of the Senate candidate or invite the Senate candidate to send a message to them.
Yesterday was the deadline for candidates to file their financial information for the third quarter of the year. It's the last deadline before the November election. How do those filing deadlines affect the timing of email from campaigns?
The filing deadlines are a really important way of creating a lot of urgency for donors. If you're on any even vaguely political list at all, Republican or Democrat, you probably got a ton of emails last night. It's the last big filing deadline. It's a campaign finance disclosure deadline. In some sense, it's an artificial deadline in that the campaigns can continue to raise money for the next month, but it's also in a very real deadline. This is the last major, this is the last campaign finance filing deadline prior to the election. This is it. And the amount of money campaigns have going into that last month of campaigning is a really important measure, creates all kinds of stories. In a few days, we'll start to see stories about which candidates raised more in Q3, and that can be a sign of a candidate's relative health. If they didn't raise as much to meet expectations, they might be perceived as being weak or vice versa strong, and that can kind of compound itself.
And do you want to save money for that filing, if you will, in order to demonstrate that your candidate or you as a candidate have momentum?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's cash flow management. You want to put off paying as many bills as you can so it looks like you have as much, and you want to raise as much money as you can So it looks like at that deadline that, like, you're very strong, that you have a ton of cash.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking with Nick O'Mealy. He is author of The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. He's a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. You can call us at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Do you get emails from political campaigns that you have no connection to? 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversation there. Talk about how campaigns and consultants test email subject lines to see which ones are the most successful. The first step, apparently, to get people to notice and open the email. What works best?
Well, it's actually really hard to figure out what works best. Sometimes you're really surprised. And so campaigns have developed a methodology called A-B testing. This methodology existed long before the internet came along in lots of direct marketing and direct mail. But the internet makes it a lot cheaper and easier to do. And what A-B testing is you'll take two groups from your email. You'll randomly select a group, two small groups from your email list. If you have an email list of 100,000 supporters, you might take two groups of 1,000 each. And you'd send them both the same message, but with a different subject line, and you would see which one got a higher open rate. And in a very sophisticated email program, like in a national campaign and presidential campaign or with one of the campaign committees, you might A-B test 5, 6, maybe even a dozen subject lines to figure out what's going to have the highest response rate, what's going to increase the likelihood people will open the email. It's very hard to say what will work. A real surprise in 2012 when Obama's 2012 presidential campaign, the best performing email subject line was famously "Hey," just H-E-Y. Does not feel like a very presidential way of talking, but it is a very informal and intimate way of talking. And in some ways, that's how we think of our inboxes, is personal, intimate space.
It's how you get someone's attention. Hey!
Well,
having gotten the reader to open the email, what's the trick to getting them to do what you're asking, whether it's donating $5 or $500?
Well, the trick is to tell a great story, to write a great email, to really be compelling about what your needs are and why it's important and urgent to have someone take action right now. I think it's not any more complicated than that, but that's actually can be pretty hard to do. I think it's important to note that even though people get a lot of email, and anyone who got a ton of email last night might be a little annoyed this morning, by and large, this really works. In fact, it would be no exaggeration to say that it is a crucial part of keeping the Democrats competitive against the Republicans in this election cycle.
On now to the telephones. Here is Jean in Germantown, Maryland. Jean, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Kojo. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm from Scotland, but I've lived here in Germantown, Maryland for 17 years. I'm not a citizen, although I have a green card. I'm here legally, so don't worry about that. I want to know why my email box is being flooded with all these from Joe Biden, Michelle Obama, Barack Obama, to name but a few. And they're all calling me by my first name. Hey, Jean. Like they know me. They know nothing about me. I'm not even a citizen. I'm not entitled to vote. And yet my email box is flooded. Where are they getting my information from?
I don't know where they're getting your information from, Jean, but the fact that you are not entitled to vote does not mean you are also not entitled to give money. So that part of the question, I can answer. The other part, Nico might be able to answer.
Okay.
Well, in all likelihood, at some point in the last few years, you signed up for something related to the campaign. You might not even remember it. Maybe a friend invited you to a house party when Obama was running for president.
I have absolutely none of that going on.
None of that?
No.
It would be really unusual for them to harvest your email from any. It would be unusual and in some cases downright improper for them to harvest your email from any unintended source. You know, most of the major email lists abide pretty strictly by what they call the opt-in rule, which is they don't email you unless you have opted in, unless you've asked to be on a list.
Yep.
What gets confusing is you might have asked to be on a list about something, and then over time that list gets converted into political fundraising, and you never expected that, you weren't paying attention, you weren't prepared for it. Maybe it's a list you signed up 6 years ago and forgot about, and now suddenly they're emailing you at the end of the quarter a whole bunch. It can be a surprise like that. That's not to say that incidences of buying or otherwise acquiring email don't happen. They do happen, but that is not the norm. That's not the standard. And frankly, that tends to be really high risk for campaigns. For Democrats, small dollar fundraising from email is giving them a substantial financial advantage this cycle. I shouldn't say advantage, but really getting to parity. The National Journal just released a study showing that Democratic candidates for Congress are outraising Republicans by more than $100,000 per candidate, all in gifts of under $200. This is a crucial tool for the Democrats. And they wouldn't risk it they wouldn't risk the spam complaints if they had acquired your email from some untoward action. That's why the opt-in is so important.
Gene, have you complained about this? Have you attempted to respond to these emails to tell them to not send them to you anymore?
No, because, you know, Kojo, I never open an email that I haven't
I don't know
the person. I just delete them. I never open them. So you can't unsubscribe.
I see, unless you
open
the
them.
Email. I see. That is your policy. You were just wondering how you were getting them. We got another tweet from someone asking, does the Obama election team sell emails or share? Do they assume I am in favor? Any selling of emails going on? Again, that could cause a lot of problems, right, Nico?
Yeah, I mean, the best practice is, like I said, not to sell, not to share, but in fact, to really make use of it, right? To use it to raise money for other candidates. Another thing I would note to all of your listeners is that, you know, there's this simple trick if you use Gmail, that if you sign up, if you have a Gmail address, username at gmail.com, if you do username plus Obama or plus, you know, insert candidate name here, you can then track how you signed up for a list and who's getting it. Gmail will ignore everything after the plus sign. And so if you put your username in there and then a plus sign, everything after it will be ignored by Gmail, but it lets you track where it's coming from. It's actually a very useful way to track marketing, not just political marketing, but when you go to a restaurant or you go to an event and they want your email and you're curious to see if they'll buy or sell, if they'll sell your email to anyone, you add that little plus sign and then the name of some identifier. You can then track how your email is being used.
And, Gene, that's something you might want to do. You can all find a full explanation for that at our website, kojoshow.org. You may want to do that yourself. We're talking with Nico Mealy. He is author of The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. He's a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. We're talking about the email deluge from political campaigns that you might be experiencing right now. Nico, some say the tone of this year's emails is more pointed than in past elections. Have you observed that?
Well, it certainly appears to be that way. We don't have a ton of quantitative data on it yet. We're collecting it and evaluating it. But the tone does look more urgent and more partisan. Dave Karp, a professor at George Washington University, has actually done some studies of email and cycles in the past and looks at ways they encourage more partisan language. That the more partisan and dramatic an email is, the more urgent it feels, the more likely you are to respond to it. And that does create some incentives for campaigns to really get worked up. Of course, I think that in many cases, the what feels like hyperbolic language in the email actually reflects how some of the really committed activists on the ground feel. They really feel like things are this urgent. And so there is this line between really being in touch with your base and communicating that you're on the same page as them. But also, you know, there is line that's overstepping it and creating a false sense of urgency that people are inclined to ignore. There is absolutely no doubt that control of the Senate is on the line this year. With both parties, it is about as tight as it's been in a long, long time, in decades.
If both parties are just as interested in controlling the Senate, why does it seem like Democrats and Democratic Party groups used fundraising emails more than Republicans?
Well, to date, the Democrats have built a small dollar donor base online in a way the Republicans haven't. It's more than 2 to 1 in terms of dollars. You're almost twice as likely to have a Democratic donor who's a small dollar donor than a Republican donor, and that's unusual. For many years, a lot of the Republican donor base was small dollar in direct mail, but really, we could say beginning with Move On in the late 90s, going to the Dean campaign where I worked, and then also to the Obama campaign, we've seen the rise of a fairly impressive, fairly aggressive small-dollar donor base in the Democratic Party.
How much money do candidates raise through email requests? Is this a big portion of their campaign cash?
You know, it varies pretty widely. Certainly in any national campaign, in a presidential campaign, or in a Senate race that is nationalized, you will see a substantial portion of the money raised online, as much as half or even more raised online. In other races, it just varies widely. Across the board, I think it is absolutely a part of every campaign's fundraising strategy. How is it 10%, 50%, 80% varies based on the campaign and factors around it. Certainly, if you're an incumbent, you're less likely to have an aggressive online fundraising program. If you're a Republican, you're less likely to have an aggressive online fundraising program. But it is across the board a standard part of every political campaign. And my general rule of thumb is the larger the campaign, the greater the volume of online fundraising.
We got a tweet from Roberta who writes, "I just unsubscribed from everything yesterday. I've had it." There's some concern, Nico, that campaigns are overdoing it right now and turning voters off with a barrage of emails. Is there a tipping point? Are we likely to see a lot more Robertas?
That's a good question. We talk a lot about quote-unquote burnout of an email list. That an email list, people who were engaged in the work stop being engaged because of the volume of fundraising appeals. But I'll say that it's like a really essential part of the Democrats' fundraising this cycle. And they're doing it because it works, because it delivers dollars. And they're going to do it until it stops working. And two, generally speaking, I think that it's okay to really aggressively fundraise from your list if the rest of the time you're really providing value. So, you know, in that sense, I think about, you know, NPR and a station like your station here, WAMU.
Yes, our fundraising drive is coming up soon.
That's right. You have times of the year when you do a very aggressive fundraising drive, but you do it because you're creating a lot of value in between those fundraising drives. And I think that the trick for campaigns is to really try and provide a lot of value to make people feel intimate and engaged in the work of the campaigns so that they'll forgive the volume of fundraising emails at different deadline moments like quarterly fundraising deadlines.
Got to take a break before we create some more value here. Nico Mealy is author of The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. He's a lecturer at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Nico, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, graphic novels or comics, their relationship to education, their relationship to diversity. We'll be talking with Jean Luen Yang about all of that. I'm Kojo Nandi. graphic novels and comic books have been enjoying a renaissance in recent years, despite the reluctance of some parents, teachers, and quote-unquote serious readers to, well, take them seriously. One of the author-illustrators leading the charge in this resurgence is Jean Luen Yang, who also happens to be a teacher, dad, and a two-time National Book Award nominee. He's here to talk with us about his work, which ranges in genre from historic fiction to a new superhero tale about the role of comics in the classroom and about the importance of creating diverse characters. Jean Luen Yang is an educator, the author of numerous graphic novels, the latest of which is The Shadow Hero, which kept me up all last night. His prior work includes American Born Chinese and Boxers and Saints. He joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Jean Yang, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kojo. I'm very excited to be here.
As I said, The Shadow Hero kept me up last night, but it was worth staying up for the read. Your first graphic novel with first, second books, American Born Chinese, is dedicated to your parents. Were they supportive of your interest in comics as a kid?
Well, first, thank you. Thank you so much for reading The Shadow Hero. I'm really glad.
Well, you pulled me in when I heard you speak at the opening of the National Book Award.
I appreciate that.
At National Book Festival here in Washington. We'll talk about that later. But yes.
That was great. But about my parents, yeah. They were not. When I was a kid, I started getting into comics in the fifth grade, and early on, I had to actually sneak to my local comic book store. I had a friend named Jeremy in the fifth grade who had been collecting comics for years and years, so he devised the system that he let me in on. And what we would do is we would get our parents to drop us off at the local library, and then we would wait till they drove away, and then we would take the 20-minute walk to our local comic book store, and we'd buy as many comics as we could out of the quarter bin. And then we'd take them back to the library and check out the biggest books that we could find so that we could hide our comics and take them home. So early on, my parents were not into it. I remember my dad used to find these articles about how comic books would stunt your reading and how the lettering was so small it would make you have to wear glasses. So they were not fans in the beginning.
Yeah, I do remember that my early relations with a lot of kids in school were only trading comics. That's the only relationship I remember having with them at all.
That's great.
In addition to being a writer, you're an educator with experience at the high school and college level. You've done a lot of work around the use of comics in the classroom. What are the strengths? What are the weaknesses of using them in the classroom?
I've taught high school for about 17 years now. Nowadays, I'm down to just one class of computer programming. But I've had a couple of experiences using comics in the classroom. First, I've taught my students to make comics in an art class. And then I've also used comics to convey educational information in a math class. And in both of those instances, I've realized that comics are this very powerful tool that here in America, at least, we as educators are just starting to explore. So a couple of things make comics stand out. First of all, comics are a visual medium, and our students are very, very used to receiving information visually, and that's one of the big advantages it has over just pure prose or pure text. And then second, unlike other visual storytelling media, there's film and there's animation. When comics conveys information visually, the rate of information exchange from the comic, from the source material to the reader, is actually in the hands of the reader, in control of the reader. The reader decides how fast or how slow she wants to read that comic. That is not true of animation or film. At least in terms of visual storytelling media, comics is the only one that has that.
800-433-8850 is our number. Our guest is Jean Luen Yang. He's an educator and author of numerous graphic novels, the latest of which is The Shadow Hero. 800-433-8850. Are you a fan of graphic novels? Tell us what appeals to you about them. If you've read Jean's work and have questions for him, give us a call. 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. It's interesting that now you teach a class in computer science, because you majored in computer science, and that is my understanding, in part to please your parents before you kind of moved on.
It was in part to please my parents, but it was also, I also had a genuine interest specifically in coding, specifically in programming. A lot of the hardware stuff I wasn't super into, but there's something really beautiful and really sequential about coding that I think is related to comics. In both of these art forms, you have to break large ideas down into almost bite-sized, easy-to-consume pieces and then put these pieces in sequential order. And you have to really think deeply about that sequence that you're building. So in a way, I really think there's this overlap. And I think it shows, too, if you look at the population, there's a huge, if you draw this Venn diagram of coders and comic book fans, there's this huge overlap space.
Well, you earned the first ever National Book Award nomination for a graphic novel, which you've since done again, as have others. And a graphic novelist was among the MacArthur Genius grantees this year. To what do you attribute this surging popularity, and where do you position your work within the range we're seeing now?
I think it's pretty awesome. I think, you know, if you had told me when I was in fifth grade starting to collect comics that we as an industry would be where we are today, I wouldn't have believed you. And I feel lucky because I feel like I'm part of this big wave that's been building for decades and decades. You know, you have Neil Gaiman, who started off in comics and won all sorts of literary awards that were originally only won by pure prose works. And then you have Art Spiegelman's Mouse, which won the Pulitzer Prize in the early 90s. First and so far only graphic novel to have won a Pulitzer Prize. So for decades, there have been cartoonists who have expressed very sophisticated and very personal visions in comics, and they've really convinced the general public that comics are a medium worthy of study, and comics are a medium that are just as literary and just as legitimate as anything else out there. So I kind of feel like, in a lot of ways, that the National Book Award nomination for American Born Chinese in 2006 was kind of me being at the right place at the right time. You know, the world of comic books and the world of traditional publishing were starting to merge in this very aggressive way, and American Born Chinese came out right when that was happening.
On to the telephones. Here is Ken in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Ken, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. I have two comments. The first is, one really cannot, you know, talk about comics without mentioning pop art and people like Tom Wesselman, who really brought the medium into fine art. The second is, I'm a physician twice over. I was educated overseas and in the United States, and what helped me get through calculus and physics were two books, The Comic Guide to Calculus and The Comic Guide to Physics. Without them, I'd have flunked out.
Yeah, Larry Gonick, the cartoonist who did those books, is great, is a great example of somebody who is both a cartoonist and an educator. I think his first big book was called The Cartoon History of the Universe, and it really is amazing. It's multiple volumes, hundreds of pages long, and he goes from the Big Bang all the way to present day.
I got to tell you, without the newspaper comics, I would not be here every day. I'd read them before I get out of bed in the morning. They're that important to me. But thank you so much for your call, Ken. One of the things that brings you here today, I mentioned earlier, was a visit you made to the Library of Congress to help kick off this year's National Book Festival. There you spoke about the issue of diversity and specifically the role that fear plays in, perhaps often subconsciously, squelching it. What inspired you to take that topic on in your address?
I am a part of the faculty at Hamline University. I teach as part of their MFA in creative writing for children and young adults. So I work with a lot of both published and aspiring writers there. It's really a wonderful storytelling community. You know, most of the folks there are either novelists or they're picture book writers or they're nonfiction writers. I'm one of just a few graphic novelists who are a part of that program. But one of the great things about that program is we get to talk to each other, you know, and we get to learn from each other's art forms. This past residency, this past summer, every summer we fly out there, all the faculty and staff fly out there for about a week. And this past residency, the theme was diversity. So we had all these discussions about how do we write about a diverse world in an authentic way. And what I noticed in talking to my students was, you know, in all of our discussions, we were trying to achieve this balance. We didn't want to write other people's cultures in a way that was disrespectful. But at the same time, we didn't want our students to get so afraid of getting things wrong that they didn't try anything. You know, they didn't try to go and explore an experience that wasn't that of their own. And what I found with a lot of my students is after all these discussions about diversity, a couple of them got really freaked out about it. And one of them even straight up told me, she said, I will never write outside of my own culture because I'm going to get it wrong and it's going to be terrible. And I thought as writers, you know, especially in a program like that, what we want to encourage is we want to encourage exploration. We want to encourage courage. And we want to encourage people learning about themselves by writing about others. You know, when you write about others, you find commonalities between your own experience and the subject of your writing. So that all of those things were swirling in my head when I was asked to do the talk at the National Book Festival.
Looking back at your own earlier work, do you feel as though that fear ever stopped, ever hamstrung you?
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, that that talk that I gave was a pep talk for myself because in an upcoming book of mine, the two main characters, the two leads are a biracial girl, a biracial middle school girl, and her best friend, who is an African-American boy. So in a lot of ways, at least, when I'm writing these two characters, I'm writing outside of my own experience. And I felt it when I started this project. I felt that fear. So I was trying to talk myself out of it. With my earlier work, you know, most of my earlier work featured Chinese-American or Asian-American protagonists. And Boxers and Saints, you know, that was a historical book that was set during the time of the Boxer Rebellion.
Yep.
So all of the protagonists are Chinese. But when I was writing that book, I realized that even though I'm a Chinese American, this is definitely a different culture. You know, when you travel back in time, you are actually traveling into, it's almost like going to another planet. It's a completely different way of thinking and a completely different way of living.
Is the book you're working on that you just referred to involving mixed race and someone of mixed race and an African-American secret coders?
It is, yeah.
You can't
Secret
wait.
Coders is the book. I'm really excited about this because, you know, in fifth grade, I started programming and I started collecting comics. And finally, in this project, I'm bringing these two things together. So I'm working with an incredibly talented cartoonist named Mike Holmes. He's doing the illustrations and I'm doing the writing. And Secret Coders is kind of like Harry Potter. You know, these kids find the secret school, but the secret school, instead of teaching magic, teaches computer coding. And we're hoping that as the reader follows these kids in their journey to become coders, that the readers themselves will become coders as well.
On to the telephones again. Here is Mara in Silver Spring, Maryland. Mara, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am the mother of a 10-year-old boy who is a great reader, and in addition to the big chapter books, he's also been a big fan of I think it started with The Arrival by Sean Tan, and then John Lewis's recent autobiography, the first section of that, Nausicaa, huge, huge fan. He can read that over and over again. But my 7-year-old daughter asked me the other day why she didn't have any graphic novels of her own, which, of course, is the first time she asked it. And I've taken note of a few of the ones you've mentioned, but I wondered if you had any other suggestions. I mean, Nausicaa is an obvious one that she can and will read, but do you have other suggestions of novels with female protagonists, comics and graphic novels that would be good for her?
How much time do you have, Mara?
Anything by Raina Teglemeyer would work perfectly. Her most well-known book is Smile, which is all about she lost her two front teeth in an accident when she was in late elementary school, and it's all about this dental drama. So any kid who has worn braces or will wear braces will relate to that book. It's beautifully, gorgeously written and drawn. There is a series called Baby Mouse by Jenny Holm and Matt Holm. That's absolutely wonderful, female protagonist. And then there's the Lunch Lady series, which is about a lunch lady who knows kung fu. It's amazing, and it's by Jarrett Krasowska. He has a really complicated last name. But if you look up Lunch Lady on your favorite book website, you'll find it.
Mara, thank you very much for your call. We've got to take a short break. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org. You'll find a link to Gene Yang's Comics in Education website. That's at our website, kojoshow.org. Gene Loon Yang is an educator and the author of numerous graphic novels. He joins us from studios in San Francisco. We'll be continuing this conversation, but you can still call 800-433-8855. 650. Are you a teacher who has used graphic novels in the classroom? Tell us how they went over both with the students and their parents. You can also go to our website, kojoshow.org, ask a question or make a comment there. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up at 1, for some local African communities, the Ebola crisis in West Africa is hitting close to home. A look at how those with ties to Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Nigeria are grappling with the issues. Plus, in with the new, how restaurant menus evolve and what to do when your favorite dish disappears. Today at 1 on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org. Welcome back. Our guest is Jean Luen Yang. He is an educator. He's the author of numerous graphic novels, the latest of which is The Shadow Hero. Prior work includes American-born Chinese and Boxers and Saints. If you go to our website, kojoshow.org, you will find a link to Jean Yang's Comics in Education website. And we talked earlier about the fact that he made a visit to the Library of Congress to help kick off this year's National Book Festival. If you go to our website, you will find a link to the text of his speech there and an interview that Michael Kavanagh had with Jean. But in the speech, you spoke about how important it is for people who are part of a minority group to see that group represented, even if it's done imperfectly. How did that experience shape the life and work of one Dwayne McDuffie, Jean?
Well, you know, I've only met Dwayne McDuffie once, and it was about a year before his death at a Comic-Con. We were on a panel together. Dwayne McDuffie was an incredibly influential comic book writer. He did work for all the major comic book companies, Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, and he even founded his own. He founded a company called Milestone Comics that started publishing diverse comics, comics featuring diverse superhero characters, when I was just finishing up my adolescence. And I remember seeing those books on the shelves and being blown away, being really excited and realizing that I was looking at something new. His most famous creation is this character called Static Shock, who had his own. He's a African American teenager who can shoot lightning out of his hands. He had his own series, top rated series, cartoon series on TV for years and years. And overall, you know, if you look at the American comic book industry as a whole, Dwayne McDuffie has just had a huge impact. You know, in this column that he wrote in the early 90s, he talked about how this character called the Black Panther, a Marvel Comics superhero, brought him into comics. He first encountered Black Panther when he was 11, and immediately he was attracted to the dignity of this character. Black Panther is actually T'Challa, who is an African prince of a fictional nation called Wakanda. And there are all sorts of problems with the Black Panther, you know, especially if you look at it from a modern lens. He has the word black in his name, which was very common with early African-American characters, as if what made him most notable was their ethnicity. You know, in his first incarnation, you know, he was created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, who are legends in sure. their own right. But in the first draft, he was actually called the Coal Tiger, and he just looked so goofy. Luckily, that didn't actually you know, the final, the one that actually made it into the comic didn't look like that. But it just goes to show that, you know, even if you're as awesome as Lee and Kirby, when you're dealing with somebody else's culture, sometimes you make a couple of missteps, especially in the beginning. So the story of Black Panther and Dwayne McDuffie, I think, really points to the fact that, first, seeing yourself in media is incredibly empowering. And second is that we as creators, we need to do our homework. We have to, if we're going to write outside of our culture, we have to do our research. We have to talk to people who are insiders of that culture. But we shouldn't be afraid of jumping in there, because more likely than not, we'll end up making our storytelling medium of choice a little bit better, you know, and a little bit more diverse.
I was in the room when you gave that speech, and it was not only obviously well delivered, but well received. I had only, I think, heard the name Dwayne McDuffie a few times before that, and it made me real curious, so I went back again. But at the time, did you feel, when you made that speech, at all nervous making it?
Oh, of course. Of course. I was, you know, E.L. Doctorow took the stage after me. It was crazy. That's like a nutty thing that happened. Even when they asked me, I couldn't believe that was going to happen. And for a long time, I thought about what can I talk about, you know, on a stage like that. And ultimately, I felt like I ought to talk about something that I felt passionately about, you know, something that happened in my life recently. You know, this discussion of diversity just happened this past summer. And somebody who I deeply admire, Dwayne McDuffie, is one of my writing heroes.
How did his work, even tangentially, shape your career path?
Well, I think, you know, Dwayne McDuffie, when he was writing in comics, he was one of just a few African-Americans working in the American comic book industry. And he was incredibly smart, too. He had a master's degree in physics, so he could have pretty much done anything he wanted in life. And he chose to write comics. He chose to go into a situation where he would most likely be an outsider, at least culturally speaking, and he chose to give it his all. So just seeing that example and reading the stories that he produced, he's incredibly talented as a storyteller, really affected me. It kind of showed me that you ought to follow your own calling, even if it leads you to uncomfortable places.
For your latest book, The Shadow Hero, you turned to the superhero genre. Which earlier character did you draw inspiration from? Where does your story, in your view, break with prior superhero tradition?
Well, I love superheroes. I grew up with superheroes, mostly because, you know, if you wanted to read comics in the 80s, you were most likely reading superhero comics. But the conventions of the genre, the masks and the secret identities, all that stuff really got into me. And as an adult, I look back on my fascination with superheroes, and I wonder if it's because I'm an immigrant's kid. You know, the dual identity that every superhero struggles with mirrors the dual identity that a lot of immigrants' kids have to live through. A lot of us have one name at home and another one at school. We speak one language at home and another one at school. We live under these two different cultural expectations. And you know, Clark Kent being Superman, that dual identity kind of mirrors our own stories. I don't think that's an accident. If you look at all of the major superheroes, they were all created by these children of Jewish immigrants. So consciously or not, I really believe that they put their own experience as the children of immigrants into this genre that they were establishing. With the Shadow Hero, I wanted to take all of that, you know, and make it explicit. So the Shadow Hero tells the story of a superhero called the Green Turtle. And the Green Turtle is actually, his secret identity is Hank Chu, who is the son of two Chinese immigrants. Now, the Green Turtle isn't my character. You know, the book is illustrated by an extraordinary cartoonist named Sonny Liu.
Sonny
and I did not create... Yes, he's great. But he and I didn't create this character of the Green Turtle. He actually comes from the 1940s. There are... you can find these issues of Blazing Comics with original Green Turtle comics in them. And he was created by this Chinese-American cartoonist named Chu Hing, who was one of the first Asian Americans in the American comic book industry. And there's a rumor about the Green Turtle. The rumor is that Chu Hing wanted him to be a Chinese American, but his publishers wouldn't let him do it. So Chu Hing reacts really passive-aggressively. He draws all of those early Green Turtle comics so that we never get to see his face. Almost every panel has him with his back facing us. And then when he turns around, there's a shadow or an arm or another character's head that blocks our view of his face. Yep. And the rumor is he did that. He hid his face from us so that he and his reader could imagine his character as he originally intended, as a Chinese-American.
On to the telephones again, where Meg in Centerville, Virginia, awaits us. Meg, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much for this show. I'm thrilled to speak with your guests. I am a 46-year-old woman who was always an avid reader but never, ever considered reading comic books. It just wasn't my thing. And I discovered your work through your book about the rosary, which I bought for my children. And I have so enjoyed using it myself. And it has opened my eyes to the benefits of graphic novels and comic books, because I have a daughter who isn't a strong reader. And so having the pictures right there with the words helps her to build vocabulary and helps her to really understand what she's reading. So I would never have known that if it weren't for your book about the rosary. So I thank you so much for that work.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for reading it. I grew up Catholic and I'm still a practicing Catholic. And I think there is a link between Catholicism and comics. If you go to any Catholic church anywhere in the world, they'll have Stations of the Cross hanging on the wall. And it's 14 images illustrating the last moments of Christ's earthly life. And whether or not the pastor wants to admit it, that is a comic. That is sequential images telling a story. So I think it points to the storytelling power of still images put in sequence.
Thank you very much for your call, Meg. And you may have answered the question of Nancy in Hampstead, Maryland, but I'll let Nancy ask it herself. Nancy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Cody, thank you for taking my call. My question was, I am the parent of a 7-year-old boy who, like many 7-year-old boys, has zero interest in reading. And I'm wondering if there is any research that proves the link between reading comics and enticing 7-year-old boys to read.
There absolutely is. There absolutely is. They've done these studies that have found that, the average comic book reader in America reads 6 times as many non-comic books, 6 times as many prose books in a year than your average American. So comics is definitely a gateway into other sorts of reading. I really believe that comics are worthy of study in and of themselves as their own medium. But at the same time, for parents and teachers, using comics as a way of introducing students and kids to the discipline of reading is a perfectly legitimate use of comics. And for your 7-year-old son, there are all sorts of great comics for him to read. There's Bone by Jeff Smith. There's this book called Zeta the Space Girl by Ben Hecke, which is absolutely amazing. There's another book called Amulet by Kazu Kibuishi. There's just, nowadays, in terms of diversity of genre, it couldn't be a better time to be a 7-year-old boy.
Indeed, Nancy, we got an email from Edie Ching, who is one of our resident librarians on our kids and young adults reading shows. Edie writes, graphic novels are an excellent way to engage reluctant readers, and it also appeals to readers who are more visual learners. They are immediately into the story, and of course it continues the tradition that began with cave painting. And part of the excitement of Jean's books are how they also promote Chinese culture. The first, celebrating the Monkey King and Boxer and Saints, a 2-part story that looks at the Boxer Rebellion from both sides. Thanks for having this wonderful author on your show. And Nancy, thank you very much for calling. We move on now to Terry in Glen Ell, Maryland. Terry, your turn.
Hi, thanks so much. My question is about kids on the spectrum, as in the autism spectrum.
Yes.
There's a very famous author and speaker, Temple Grandin, who has written a lot about thinking and pictures, that spectrum persons tend to think in pictures. So I wondered if the author has any opinion or knowledge of how the spectrum kids are huge fans of manga, anime, and I certainly have a son who fits in that category. And we wonder how we can make that leap that the spectrum kids can use their hyper-focus and being visual learners into finding some type of a job or a hobby in your profession.
And we only have about a minute left, Jean Yang, by the way. Anthony tweeted to ask, can you comment on how manga, Japanese comics, might have influenced the resurgence of graphic novels in America? All in a minute.
I there are three major comic book cultures in the world. There's the American one, the European one, and the Japanese one. Each of them has their own way of telling stories. And it was only recently that there's been a lot of crossover between these three cultures. So nowadays in America, you know, comic book readers and comic book creators are drawing from both Japanese and American traditions. It's a really exciting time. In terms of autism, I'm not an expert, but I do know that comics has always been a home for people who may be considered outsiders from the very beginning. I think that's why so many immigrants' kids have been drawn into the medium. And so many people who may feel like they're different from the mainstream, I think, are able to find a voice here. If your kid is interested in telling stories, I would strongly encourage them to look into telling their stories as comics, because as a medium, we need those outsider voices.
That's all the time we have. Jean Lun Yang, he's an educator and the author of numerous graphic novels, the latest of which is The Shadow Hero. Jean Yang, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Kojo. It was great.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, DC tests body cameras for police officers. Police Chief Kathy Lanier joins us. Then at 1, escalating protests in Hong Kong, Secret Service snafus, a new paid leave policy for DC government workers. It's your turn to set the agenda. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.